You cannot stop that.
Albert Hammond Jr. I knew I would shoot up drugs from a very young age. I'd been wanting to do heroin since I was 14 years old. Adam Green. Albert's always been pretty lavish. Albert Hammond Jr. It's the perfect drug, it really is. I was home.
Catherine Pierce. He used to say, I love drugs, I'm not an addict, I love drugs.
Albert Hammond Jr. I'm not sure where it began. Everywhere? I'd find it anywhere. When things started getting bigger, everything else just became easier. Because people will just get you things because you ask for it. You're backstage, and one day you're like, oh, we're out of beers. And all of a sudden there's another case of beer. And you're like, oh, that didn't happen before. It's also money. You have a certain amount of money, so you do a certain amount of partying. And then the money becomes more. And then all of a sudden you can indulge constantly.
Kelly Kiley. I just remember the trip when... Obviously, this was not the first thing they said to me, but at some point they said, get us drugs.
Albert Hammond Jr. In that room on fire time, I definitely got into a lot of pills, and the beginning of opiates. That OxyContin kind of thing. With a glass of wine? Ha! No, like cut up an 80 with Coke and mix it. I was always pretty extreme.
Catherine Pierce. Albert and Julian really loved each other and were kind of dependent on each other. Julian's acceptance was really important to Albert, and I think Albert's opinion was really important to Julian.
Albert Hammond Jr. When Julian and I stopped living together, that's kind of when it changed. Julian Casablancas. I thought I pressured him to stay roommates. I was definitely more into that than he was. But then it just kind of took its natural course. We didn't have a falling out or anything, but he had a long-time girlfriend. He was engaged. Nothing negative happened. It wasn't like, I'm out of here, bro. And he was like, no, why, Papa, no, don't go. No way. Albert Hammond Jr. We were such perfect living partners, because even though we were so different, we were both very carefree. Our doors were never closed, even when girls were over. You could just come in. It was like, oh, am I interrupting you? When we first moved in together, it was more a celebration of the dream of leaving home. And we could share in that. And guess what? We're also going to play in a band together. It was innocent. I feel a lot of the drugs and alcohol I did were to chase that feeling of just being young.
Catherine Pierce. It was such a weird time because everybody was simultaneously psyched about, oh, we're all becoming famous. This is awesome. Let's all hang out. But it was also like, wait, Ryan's a bad influence.
Albert Hammond Jr. I remember Julian threatening to beat Ryan up if he hung out with me, as a protective thing. He'd heard that Ryan would come and give me heroin. So he was just like, if you come to my apartment again with heroin, I'm going to kick your ass. I hadn't really been doing it in baggy form until Ryan showed up. He was definitely a bad influence. Ryan Adams. That's so sad, because Albert and I were friends. If anything, I really felt like I had an eye on him in a way that they never did. I was around, and we actually spent time together. He would show me his songs. It was like, no one ever listens to my music, but do you want to hear it? I would be like, fuck yeah. I loved him so deeply. I would never ever have given him a bag of heroin. I remember being incredibly worried about him, even after I continued to do speedballs. Mark Spitz. The New Orleans sessions were a bust, so Ryan came back to New York to record with Barber, who I knew as Courtney Love's boyfriend. He called me. Hey, Mark, it's Jim Barber. Why don't you come to Niagara? I want to play you something. I'm making this really great record with Ryan. Ryan can't make a bad record in spite of himself. He's talented. He had that song, Note to Self, Don't Die. It was a good song. And that song, which I think is literally called This Is It. But by this point, Ryan's made the transformation to full-on stroke. And not just coked-out Graham Parsons wannabe. He's now added heroin to the cocaine. I know this because I did heroin with him in the basement of Black and White. Julian Casablancas. Did I specifically tell Ryan to stay away from Albert? I can't remember the details, to be honest. I think heroin just kind of crosses a line. It can take a person's soul away. So it's like if someone is trying to give your friend a lobotomy, you're gonna step in. Ryan Adams. I didn't do drugs socially, and I don't remember doing drugs with Albert ever. I wanted to smoke cigarettes and drink, like dark red wine or vodka, and write all night. I've just always been this wannabe beat poet guy. Hunter S. Thompson, Jack Kerouac. I want to stay up all night, and you can't do that on heroin. I wanted to drink but still feel totally capable of operating a helicopter. I wanted to be drunk but be able to do calculus. Mark Spitz. Ryan told me he wanted his life to be like a movie. He didn't want to live real life. He wanted life to be like this romantic, tragic, nouvelle vague movie where the hero dies at the end. He was framing his own legend, and part of it would be an early death. There's no other reason to do as much heroin and cocaine as he was doing. Ryan Adams. I loved doing drugs in New York City so fucking much, and I would never tell somebody to do it or not do it. I never have felt a day of regret or remorse for any drug I ever did, because I very much felt like there was some kind of urban alchemy. I did drugs with the idea of creating in mind. James Endicott. Albert getting into smack was just ridiculous. Ryan Adams. I do remember thinking that the Strokes guys were way more into heroin than I was. James Endicott. Julian was dabbling, as we say. He was a dabbler. I don't think he was a frequent user, but he was definitely a dabbler. I just know that heroin was around, and that he wasn't like, oh my God. Ryan Adams. It was very dramatic the way it all went down. Very much in the style of The Godfather, where the family business was being attended to. The family included me, and the other artists Ryan was spending time working with. Fabrizio Moretti. I'm sure Ryan Adams has his own story, and it's grandiose and beautiful and whatnot, but he's not that major of a player in the Strokes' history. Ryan Adams. I was asked to meet one single person in a bar, and I got there and it was the whole band and Ryan. I was more or less given a lecture, a hypocritical lecture, and then they told me that I was not going to be a part of their scene anymore. It was very weird. Julian Casablancas. I was trying to protect my friend. It didn't help. I don't know. Maybe that isn't my place, but if I had to do it again, I would have done the same thing. Ryan Adams. I remember that conversation, that talk at the bar, being a lot of blame and a lot of vibes. The impression was you turned him on to this. But the irony is, and I think I said this that night to Julian, that he was talking about the drug that he came to my apartment several nights ago asking for. Not Albert, Julian. Julian was so angry at me that night. I think Julian was looking for me to be upset. I just remember feeling dirty. I remember feeling like, what the fuck did I do? It didn't make any sense. But I just said, okay, man, well, do you want another beer? He said, sure. So I ordered a couple beers and went to the bathroom. I couldn't have been gone more than 2 minutes. And when I got back, they were all gone. For the record, I finished my and Julian's round. James Barber. Albert magically stopped doing heroin the minute Ryan Gentles didn't manage Ryan Adams anymore, right? Ryan Adams. It was easy to brand me as the problem. I would suspect that they soon learned that I was not the problem. Nick Valenci. There might have been a night that would have ended up drug-free if Ryan hadn't showed up, you know? Not to say Ryan was an angel, because he certainly was not. He was a severe drug addict. But is it fair to label him as a bad influence? No, that's not fair at all. Everyone was down. Whoever was doing drugs, no one was getting forced or peer pressured into doing it. People did it when they wanted to do it. And by the way, a lot of people in my circle and my band didn't even fucking do drugs. Nikolai doesn't do drugs. Fab doesn't, barely. once in a blue moon. Julian's thing at the time was more drinking, anyway. Julian would do drugs so he could keep on drinking. Albert was more... he had more of a romantic relationship with it. Albert Hammond Jr. For me, the drug stuff was the release. I don't know how to explain it. Success depressed me. Julian Casablancas. It was all exciting and amazing, but at the same time, I always just felt like it was not on steady ground. James Endicott. That was a particularly dark time. It had lost its fun. It had lost its spark. They weren't a gang anymore. It splintered. Ryan Adams. That night at the bar, I just remember thinking, I just lost some friends, but I didn't understand why. There was a lot of weird little dramas along on the pathway to that. You know, the stuff that makes all the Shakespeare plays work. But at the same time, that all seemed to be part of the soup of that time. And strangely, counter to the reputation of me being a madman, I actually was pretty zen about a lot of it. I never pressed them after that. I didn't call or get mad or retaliate. I moved on. Chapter 56. If you believed what you read, Williamsburg was the new village. Tarush Alvi. Something happened. We all retreated to Brooklyn because we were poor, right? Cut to a year or two later, somebody decided to call Vice the hipster Bible. Some magazine wrote an article about how awesome it was in Williamsburg with the music scene and Vice being here. And it just kind of became part of our identity. The Sydney Morning Herald wrote an article about this very corner, North 11th and Wythe, and suddenly all these tourists showed up to take pictures of it.
Alex Wagner. Vice was definitely the most well-positioned to capitalize. They understood the scene and were documenting the whole thing already, and then all these bands blew up, and the magazine blew up, and all the groundwork that was laid in the partnership between advertising and editorial, they were right where they needed to be to explode.
Todd P. It's important to note that nightlife changed in New York with the smoking ban. Tunde Edebimpe. The smoking ban we can understand way more than the dancing ban. Only one of those is a health concern, depending on how bad of a dancer you are. Todd P. You couldn't smoke in bars anymore, and people still wanted to smoke like crazy. When the city started enforcing the smoking rules really hard is also when they started enforcing IDs. It took until about 2008 before all the bars actually started closing at 4, because they used to all stay open until 7. But once you kick people out on the street, you end up having people yelling at each other, and then you have noise complaints. Noise complaints means the whole bar scene gets more regulated. That changed the whole vibe. So that's a huge difference, and that's part of why the warehouse parties got so popular so fast. That's part of why Brooklyn happened. Jimmy Goodwin. All of a sudden, everyone was Williamsburg this, Williamsburg that. If you believed what you read, Williamsburg was the new village, and some warehouse venue out there was the fucking Café Wa. Jesse Mallon. It became move to Brooklyn, be in a band, wear a funny shirt. Todd P. The parties started to become a good, cool scene to go to, not to mention the whole underground vibe of, oh, they're selling alcohol illegally, it's kind of a secret. Oh, it's a neat location? There's a little bit of real estate voyeurism in going to these different lots and spaces, too. The thing is, it had gotten to a point where everything happening in Manhattan, because of the stakes and expenses of opening up a place, and the impossibility of doing something underground, everything got quite deliberate. And it got really, really contrived and commercial. Because by definition, when you have to get some guy to give you 500 grand to open a bar, he's not going to be like, here's your 500 grand, just run it on a good vibe. Vito Roccaforte. I think North 6 might have been the first venue to open up. Rob Sheffield. North 6 had the thing, which is so crucial to any rock scene, where you might hear a band, an opening band that you've never heard before, that would become your next favorite band. The first time I saw the Hold Steady, I was there to see Les Savefaves, who I love. I'd never heard of the Hold Steady. They came on, and I was like, this is a band? They don't look like a band. They started doing positive jam, and by the end of their set, I had my new favorite band, and I was like, that's just it, because it's this place.
Tricia Romano, you started seeing a lot of rock star DJs in Brooklyn. You'd have Interpol bring their iPods or their CDs and go DJ a party.
Rob Sheffield. At North 6, there was always going to be a surprise happening. I went to a show once, and Carlos and Nick Zinner were DJing, just in the basement of North 6. I forget even what band I was there to see.
Tricia Romano. DJ culture was so purist. The idea was that you had to be really skilled. You had to be studying this for 10 years. You can't just plug in your iPod. But people were like, well, let's just see what Nick Zinner would play. All of a sudden, you'd have these parties where there were guys who were real DJs who would be paired with Nick Zinner or Franz Ferdinand. And they were the marquee because they were the rock stars. You started to really see those two worlds collide. And, of course, LCD Sound System was a big part of it as well. Like the Rapture, LCD Sound System really married the two worlds.
Vito Roccaforte. The first big Brooklyn DFA show was at Warsaw. It was us, Black Dice, Juan McLean, and James playing drums. James brought in a ripping PA, like twice the size of what was in there. It was so loud. I remember sitting in the dressing room, and there was a line around the building. We were like, holy shit, there's people here? Crazy people. It was packed, and that place was big, especially for the time. So that was a real moment for DFA, and it happened in Brooklyn.
Alex Wagner. The gentrification was beginning, and by gentrification, I mean that in the most rudimentary way. White people started moving into neighborhoods where previously there'd been white ethnic working class people or minority ethnic working class people. You could still get these cool spaces. You could set up offices over there, and there was just so much more room. You could create a scene where none had existed previously. You didn't need the built-in history of the Manhattan cultural matrix. You could forge your own territory with space and low rent in Brooklyn.
Chris Taylor. I lived in a big loft space that my roommates and I built. It was on North 11th and Berry, which is now the armpit of Williamsburg. If there is ever like a Williamsburg Street Epcot Center, it would have to be North 11th. You had a record store, you had a cocktail bar, a bowling alley, a barbecue place, a hip hotel, Vice magazine around the corner. It was just, what the hell happened? It was totally vacant when I moved there. It was nothing.
Alex Wagner. There was not a Brooklyn identity yet. Brooklyn just felt newer. And I think that made it easier for people to kind of pave over Brooklyn's history. That's why Williamsburg is all new condos, right? Or lofts that have been converted and the rent is quadrupled. I don't mean to short shrift artists who came up in Brooklyn. Much respect to Biggie Smalls. But there wasn't the same kind of entrenched artistic scene there to protest the gentrification in the way that there has been in Manhattan.
Sarush Alvi. This was the era of zero culpability, non-stop partying, and creativity. Ed Drost. My friends Sophie and Lisa started a fashion line, Venikava. Lisa lived in a bodega storefront, and they couldn't really use their natural light because it was just an exposed window, so they would keep the metal barricade down most of the time. They had these crazy Halloween costume parties.
Alex Wagner. I remember thinking, like, I wasn't alive for the 60s and 70s, but this is what it was like.
Todd P. The guys from Chick 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 and I saw this dance party at Tommy's Tavern, where they'd play old soul records. This was 2002, 2003, right after Electro Clash. People were in the mood to dance, but they'd gotten sick of that music. Tommy's was a super seedy bar where homeless guys went to shoot up or fuck each other. We used to call it the murder bar. They had served food to the old Irish worker guys in Greenpoint years ago, but they'd gotten rid of the kitchen, and they just had this cheesy room in the back with bad disco lights that was closed all day long. There was a needle exchange on that block, and a weekly motel. We thought it was the perfect place to have a party. Ed Drost. No one had a problem going out until like 4 or 4:30 on a Wednesday, every Wednesday. Rob Sheffield. The first time I heard James Murphy DJ was opening for Black Dice. The singer Vince Martin, who was a Greenwich Village folkie from the early 60s, was also playing. I remember James played Donna Summer's I Feel Love into Hawkwind's Silver Machine, and I was like, holy shit, that is some visionary shit. Really, that sums up the whole DFA style right there. A DJ badass enough to play those two songs back to back. And you know what? Nobody stopped moving. Everyone was totally into both those songs, like they were both from the same freaky place. Here we were in Brooklyn with the Black Dice, an extreme noise band, James Murphy DJing, and Vince Martin playing his songs. He's in his 70s at that point, and he's explaining his songs, all the stories behind them. It was just amazing. Wow, this is all these different generations of the same New York bohemia dream. Leave your town and go to the city and meet all the other scroungers and hustlers and phonies who are all bullshitting the same way that a new generation of phonies are going to be bullshitting a couple of years from now. James's set was like a bridge from early 60s Bleecker and MacDougall bohemia to Bedford and metropolitan noise 40 years later. It was beautiful. And it definitely happened in Brooklyn. Chapter 57. Soviet Kitsch.
Regina Spektor. I didn't know about the Strokes when all of New York already knew. I was just playing around the city. This guy, Alan Benzozzi, came to one of those shows, and he was friends with Gordon Raphael.
Gordon Raphael. After Is This It, the first thing I did was go to England. The nicest thing the Strokes did, other than hiring me to do that record and being cool, was they put my picture the same size as their picture on the record, so people started recognizing me. I was in England, going to parties and fielding jobs non-stop. This was the dream life. I had a royalty check, I had a cool apartment, I was working in really good studios where English engineers were making me tea.
Regina Spektor. Alan said, Gordon's the producer of The Strokes, and he's been living in London, but he's going to come through, and we should do a song with him. He was saying The Strokes like it should mean something.
Ryan Gentles. The Strokes were recording Room on Fire with Gordon at TMF Studios on 12th Street between University and Broadway. It closed down as soon as we were done recording. We were the last record recorded there. Gordon Raphael. Alan said to me, I got this girl Regina Spektor. You want to record her? I said, no, actually. I've recorded the coolest bands in the world this year, and I'm fucking tired. He said, come on, Gordon. She's this 21-year-old Russian girl. Don't you at least want to meet her? So I said, okay, I'll meet her, but I'm not recording anything.
Regina Spektor. We did one song.
Gordon Raphael. We met at TMF Studios, and up comes this young girl wearing some really funky clothes who had a big smile and was really cute. She shook my hand, and I said, what do you do? There was a piano nearby, and she pulls a chair over and whips a drumstick out of her purse, puts her left hand on the piano, and starts singing some of the most outrageous lyrics I'd ever heard. Like Joni Mitchell and the Moldy Peaches in One. It was Poor Little Rich Boy. I'm thinking, people are going to love this. I love this. I have to record this.
Regina Spektor. He gave me the Strokes record Is This It, which I still hadn't ever heard, and we started making my record Soviet Kitsch. So in the backdrop of making that record, I'm listening on my CD Walkman during my 5-hour daily subway ride to the Strokes record. I really got into it. It got so into my soul. It was like a sickness. I fell in love with that record.
Gordon Raphael. I couldn't stop thinking about Regina's album. I wanted to play it for Julian. But Julian hated everything I ever played for him. Why would this rock and roll guy ever want to hear a girl playing piano? But one day, in the studio for Room on Fire, I said, would you like to listen to something? And he looked at me like, if you dare. I played Poor Little Rich Boy. And to my surprise, he said, play another one. I played The Flowers. He said, make me a CD of this. I need to take this home. I was thinking, oh my God, if I tell Regina Spektor that Julian Casablancas is taking her CD home, she's going to do a dance. So the next day, I'm by myself tweaking something on the computer, when Julian comes up behind me and gives me a big hug and a kiss on the cheek, which he always did, and he started singing The Flowers in my ear. Then he picks up an acoustic guitar and plays it. He says, I wrote these same chords 3 years ago, but her chorus just kills mine.
Regina Spektor. It was very exciting.
Ryan Gentles. Gordon took Julian to a show that she was playing, and when he saw it, he was like, oh, she's gotta come on tour with us. Chapter 58. The Southern Strokes. Ben Blackwell. Right before Room on Fire came out, the Strokes were in Detroit, playing at the State Theater. Kings of Leon were opening, and that was their first tour. Regina Spektor was on the bill, too. Regina Spektor, Kings of Leon, and the Strokes. Nick Valenci. Our A&R guy, Steve, he found Kings of Leon. The Southern Strokes. That's how they were pitched to me.
Jenny Eliscu. Steve was very prescient with the Kings of Leon, for sure.
Steve Ralbovsky. Their manager, Ken Levitan, is an old friend of mine. He had this guy who worked for him, who found Nathan and Caleb. Caleb Followill. I always knew I wanted to make music. We were at my grandma's house in Jackson, Tennessee, when we wrote our first song. Nathan was always a drummer, but I didn't play an instrument, so we wrote it a cappella, and we continued to do that. We'd listen to old soul music and old country music, and started writing tunes like that. Then we got to Nashville, and people were drawn to us for some reason. But the record labels and everyone, thank God, they were scared of us. They knew that there was something wild about us. Nathan Followill. I mean, not a lot of country artists will sing a song called Tranny. Caleb Followill. Nathan and I would go in there with the Nashville songwriter at 9 o'clock in the morning. They'd be drinking coffee, and we would tell them what the song was about. And they would be like, it's way too early to be singing a song about that. But it was a blessing in disguise, because they kept pushing us off until we got better and better, honed our craft. Then we met this guy, Angelo. Steve Ralbovsky. Angelo Petraglia was very much the big brother. He showed them his record collection and helped them write these songs, and they did some demos. Caleb Followill. We'd smoke hash and listen to the Rolling Stones and write 30 songs about, you know, Jesus and fucking and incest. Steve Ralbovsky. Ken gave me the music and I listened to the songs, and I liked them. He said, okay, well, I'll bring them to New York and they'll sing in your office. Nathan Followill. It was me and Caleb, and our buddy Angelo, and Ken Levitan went with us. Caleb Followill. We stayed in Hell's Kitchen. Nathan Followill. At the luxurious Washington Jefferson Hotel. The room was so small that Caleb could flush the toilet from his bed. I think our first meal was at Rosie O'Grady's. We went in there, and the person that was working asked if we were in a band, and we were like, oh hell yes, we're famous. We proceeded to eat there for 3 days in a row, the same exact place. I mean, I hate French onion soup, and I ate it every day just because we felt so proud that they had recognized us as guys that were in a band. Caleb Followill. We got in there right at the end of New York being so cool. We were going to bars, and there was still smoking, and everyone was doing drugs right out in the open, and everything was just happening. Nathan Followill. Our very first cab ride coming in from the airport. Angelo gets up front with the cab driver, and me and Caleb are in the back seat. We're just amazed. We can see the lights driving in, and we're like, oh my God, that's the biggest downtown we've ever seen in our lives. The cab driver starts talking to Angelo, and we're not really paying attention. Then Angelo kind of turns around and gives us a look of slight panic. The guy is saying, you know what I'm going to do when I leave here? No, what? Well, my wife is fucking my best friend right now, so I'm going to go home and get a butcher knife and kill both of them. I'm going to cut her throat and I'm going to fucking gut him. And he is dead serious. Angelo is going, you know, sometimes you can just talk things out, man. Just totally trying to defuse the situation. And then he texts us from the front seat. This guy's a total fucking nut job. I've seen a lot of weirdos in my life in New York, but this guy takes the cake. Just don't say anything. Do not engage him. Let's just try to get to the hotel alive. So that was our first ever experience of New York City. A cab driver telling us that he was going to go home to kill his cheating wife and best friend. I think we even kept looking in the papers the next day to see if a woman from Queens had been butchered. Caleb Folliwell. We went to 9 labels and got 7 record deal offers, which was pretty crazy. It was just me and Nathan and Angelo. We had an acoustic guitar and a tambourine, and we won them over. Steve Ralbovsky. I loved it. I flipped.
Jenny Eliscu. Steve called me up one day and said, these guys, they came into my office. 2 brothers. They had weird Beatles bangs.
Nathan Folliwell. Early on, our sound was so southern rock. We got compared to Lynyrd Skynyrd and Allman Brothers and all that. But the crazy thing is, we never even listened to that kind of music. Oddly enough, our first show in New York was at Mercury Lounge, and one of the Allman Brothers was there. I think it was someone from Rolling Stone that recognized the guy and was like, hey, so what do you think about people saying that these guys are going to carry the southern rock torch? He said, wait, what do you mean? I thought they were British. The writer had to tell him we were from Tennessee. He thought it was just us trying to dress the part and sound like it, you know? Southern rock royalty did not even know we were southern.
Jenny Eliscu. They were huge fans of the Strokes, and they sang a cappella in Steve's office. Nathan played drums on his legs, and Steve was like, this is cool as fuck. Immediately he was in love.
Steve Ralbovsky. I said to them, what do you guys know about RCA Records? And the two of them said in unison, The Strokes. Caleb Folliwell. If you ever wanted to be in a rock and roll band, and you watched The Strokes come out, it was like, holy shit, that is a rock and roll band. And that is what I want to be. Nathan Folliwell. By that point, the whole world was ready for some dirtiness and sweat and some sex and some rock and roll. I think it could not have come at a better time. If we'd come along 3 years earlier, hell no. You're not going to compete with NSYNC for space at a Virgin record store. That's just not going to happen. I mean, the White Stripes were trying to do it during all that pop stuff, and it didn't happen until after that pop stuff died down. Everyone was like, check out this amazing new band, the White Stripes. And I'm like, they've actually been making records for a while. Just no one gave them the time of day because it wasn't Hit Me Baby on My Butt One More Time or whatever. We would go buy jeans and then have our mom sew them and then make them so tight. Our mom did all of our tailoring for us and our hair. She was basically a one-stop shop. Back then, I can remember Jared having to straighten his legs out so stiff just to pull them on. And then we would lift him up and he could not bend his knees for a good 30 minutes. What do they say? They say style over comfort or something. We'd even wear girl jeans when we could find them to fit us properly. But sometimes the pockets were a little too girly for us on the back, and we're like, shit, that's not rock and roll at all. Kids here in Nashville would laugh at us with our skin-tight girls' jeans, and our uncles would call us their nieces. After we saw the Strokes, we were like, if we want to wear skinny jeans and grow our hair out and wear Converse and vintage t-shirts, awesome. That's cool. Who gives a shit? Steve Ralbovsky. So after that showcase, which wasn't really a showcase, I said, well, let's go hang out later. I'll show you guys where the Strokes would hang out and drink and have fun when they made their first record. So I took them to 2A, and we sat upstairs, you know, kitty corner from Gordon's Transporter-Rom on Avenue A. We sat there, and they told me their whole life story.
Kim Taylor Bennett. Every nugget you heard about the Folliwells' backstory was more outlandish than the last. Okay, they were 3 dirt-poor southern sons of a preacher, plus a cousin, fine. But then you found out Folliwell Sr. was an evangelical Pentecostal preacher, while their mom, Betty Ann, led worship, and the boys assisted. They were homeschooled, but they had no home to speak of because the family would travel the southern states in a Chrysler spreading the word of God. Pop music was verboten. Then the next chapter of their childhood unfolded, and you heard their dad was seduced by the very sins he was campaigning against, alcohol and women, and he divorced Betty Ann. Of course, this fall from grace rocked the boys to the core, and the next step was the boys falling for rock and roll. That tension between the exploration of hedonism and the tenets on which they were raised was for sure part of their early appeal.
Nathan Falwell. One time we did an interview with a magazine, and they showed up with DNA swab kits. They wanted a saliva sample from all of us to run a DNA test to see if we were all truly related, because they thought it was a made-up story that the label had put together. I swear to God. Steve Ralbovsky. That was our first date, at 2A. Nathan Falwell. We were just amazed that that it was a bar full of strokes, like people that looked like them, that dressed like them. We were like, holy shit. This is a way of life for these people. This isn't just them acting. Steve Ralbovsky. Now, at the time, I was thinking of them more in the tradition of the band. They called themselves the Falwells, because that was the family name. And in fact, the reason why Ethan Johns produced their first EP and later albums was because of the Ryan Adams Heartbreaker record. I initially saw them much more folksy and rootsy, sort of post-church rustic Levon Helm, Woodstock Dylan and the band, Van Morrison thing. Those were the antecedents, whether they knew them or not. That's what I was feeling. Nathan Falwell. Everyone was learning to play their instruments together. Jared had never played before. Caleb had never played before. Our cousin Matt had taken lessons 5 years earlier. I'd played drums, but the last time I played drums was in church when I was 17. Ethan Johns. Jared was 15 when we made that first EP. Nathan Falwell. Jared was still a freshman in high school. Matt was a sophomore in high school. Ethan Johns. They just pinned me to the back wall the first time I saw them. I was like, holy shit, these guys are amazing. I thought on every level that they were incredible. Caleb, lyrically, I mean, he's a good writer. Really interesting. Wicker Chair is an amazing song for kids to write. Tranny, off the first album. That's an extraordinary lyric for a 20-year-old guy to be writing. They were really eager to learn. They were totally committed to what they were doing and obviously hungry. Hungry to get out of the situation that they were in. They had a pretty extraordinary childhood.
Kim Taylor Bennett. You only had to spend 5 minutes with them to realize they weren't some record industry ruse. No matter how bad shit got or how badly they might behave, the Falwells stick together.
Nathan Falwell. We actually had a couple of meetings with RCA. The first time we met with them, Bob Jamieson was the president, and he took us out in a 1986 limo with a pimp-looking driver and blasted Run DMC and got us shit-faced, so that was fun. The second time we went back to New York, they brought out the big dogs. At Atlantic, we met Ahmet Erdogan, and we did not even know who that was. We left, and Angela was like, holy shit, you didn't know who that guy was? And we said, who? The old turtle-looking guy they just brought out from the office back there? And then Angelo told us he signed Ray Charles. He signed and just went down the list. But Ahmet was so funny. In the meeting he said, I'm going to give you some advice. Don't let the record label fuck this up. Y'all are too good for this shit. Don't let them fuck it up. And the guys at Atlantic were all, ha ha ha, he's joking, guys. Ahmet, you kidster, you... But he was dead serious. Great advice. Caleb Falwell. When we went to RCA, and we actually signed the deal, it was me and Nate signing the record deal. And then we had Jared with us, who was a little teeny teenage kid, and my mom and stepfather, and the record label gave us a limousine. We went to the Yankees game. They put us up with a steak dinner. It was old school rock and roll. We were the last of a dying breed to get that deal. Nathan Falwell. There's a picture of us signing our record deal in New York City. My mom, my stepdad, and Jared. They're all in the picture with us. But we didn't know yet that Jared, this little 13-year-old kid happy to be in the big city and proud of his big brothers, was going to become our bass player. Our mom lost all three boys at once. She was not too happy with that. But she's happy with the Mercedes now. Caleb Falwell. I remember walking out of RCA and seeing a massive picture of the Strokes on the wall. I was like, that's going to be me. Steve Robovsky. When we were recording the EP, we didn't want to do it in Nashville, because we didn't want Nashville to be part of the story. We went to Memphis. We commissioned videos. We filmed them recording. We filmed them driving around in a van, pointing out different places around Memphis and Jackson, where they had lived when they were younger, relatives' houses and stuff. And it turned into this 8-minute film that really was the lightning rod for UK media. It was the thing that our publicist over there took around to show to editors at Mojo and NME, and people were fascinated. It was the Southern Strokes, this too-good-to-be-true story about the alcoholic preacher dad and getting homeschooled and driving from town to town for church revival meetings.
Jenny Eliskew. Steve sent me a press kit and some music. Eventually, there was some place we were able to fit them in Rolling Stone, so literally the very first interview that they did was a phoner with me. It was Nathan. He was awesome.
Imran Ahmed. The best bands always have their own universe. They kind of land from outer space and have their own world that you can plug into. The Kings of Leon, being from the South and the U.S., were very different. They were really young. They had this insane story, and the songs were great. Nathan Falwell. We had done an EPK, electronic press kit, earlier that had Holy Roller Novocaine and all that stuff on it. The Brits had just picked that up, started playing Molly's Chambers and Holy Roller, and it blew up. So we're halfway through making our first record in Los Angeles, and our manager said, "Man, we gotta go over there. Y'all are hot right now. We need to go over there, put a face with the music, and start making the rounds." We were like, "Well, shit. We're halfway through our first record. We have like 5 songs. Are you kidding me?" But we went and did it anyway. Caleb Falwell. We'd only played a handful of concerts, you know? We were still very green. And the night before we left for England, we're staying at this condo in a little suburb of L.A. There was this little Thai restaurant across the street where we would go every night and drink sake every night and eat. There was this girl working there that I kind of thought was cute. And that night she just kept pouring me sake, and I kind of blacked out. As the story goes, we were walking down the street back to our apartment, because we had this early flight, and I fell into the bushes right in front of a bunch of cops, and they just kind of laughed at me. I went upstairs, and we all went to bed, and the next morning I woke up, and there was a glass table in the living room that was completely shattered. Apparently someone had pissed in the closet. I think all of it was me, but I didn't know. We got on the airplane, and I had full-on alcohol poisoning. It was awful. We were sitting in coach. I was like in the middle, and I was in a barf bag the whole time. So we finally land in London. I'm just a weak shell of a man. We get into the car, and they put on XFM, and the first song was Molly's Chambers. We pulled over, and we're all dancing like, "Holy shit, our song's on the radio!" We got back in the car, and 3 songs later was Red Morning Light. So we pulled over again and danced again. By the time we got to the hotel, they had played 5 of our songs. What a great country. Nathan Falwell. We came home from that trip and the fire was lit. Steve Robovsky. I also sent that EPK to Ryan Gentles with an EP. I didn't even know they would watch it. I thought it was so different to what the Strokes were culturally, geographically, background-wise, that they wouldn't like it. Well, the opposite happened. A. They actually watched it, which I'm still surprised that they took it out of the box and put in a VHS tape. And B, they loved it. Ryan called and said, "We want to see if these guys will go out on tour with us." And that began a really intensely productive relationship. Matt Romano. We still had the WizKid office on 7th Street, and I was working there at the time, doing the fan club, when Ralbovsky sends over this VHS EPK. Me and Juliet watched it and were like, oh my god, these guys are fucking great. They have to open for the band. The office wasn't just the office, it was like the clubhouse. And Fab came in and watched, and he didn't like it. They weren't totally sold, but then Julian liked them. Julian was the cool kid. He has this thing where, to this day, everybody that is close to him and has worked with him wants to please him like a parent. So the Kings came on tour. Caleb Folliwell. We played a concert in New York. They would never tell us who was at the show, because they don't want to make us nervous. I remember walking off stage, and it was Ben Queller, Evan Dando, and the Strokes. And we were just, holy shit, this is really happening. These people actually really are into what we are doing. We started to talk, and we just hit it off. And I know Julian was always a big fan of our personalities, and the way that we shot straight and didn't give a shit about the consequences. It just went from there. When we went on the road with them every night, he would give a heartfelt speech about us, and say that we were the real deal and not to take us for granted. We became close. Nick Valenci. It seemed like it was a very natural thing to do, to invite them on tour with us, because our music was so in line and we had the same record company, the same A&R guy. And they were big potheads like me. It made sense. Chapter 59. The Columbia Hotel. Harmar Superstar. The Columbia was like a weird youth hostel for bands. Mick Rock was always sitting in the lobby, waiting to find the new guys. Nick Valenci. The first time we went to England, we stayed at the Columbia Hotel. We met a few other bands.
Kelly Kiley. It was a rite of passage hotel. All our baby bands stayed there. Eleanor Friedberger. My brother got scabies there once. It was disgusting, but it was cool. Karen Ruttner. It was essentially the London equivalent of the Riot House in L.A. It was super cheap, kind of shitty, and that's where all the bands stayed. It had a lobby bar that was open pretty much until they started hating you. Like, that was the rule. They would stay open until everyone started pissing them off, and then they would just randomly shut down.
Nathan Folliwell. That's the first hotel we ever stayed at in the U.K., in London. Caleb Folliwell. I wouldn't call it a hotel. It was a shitty little place, but every band was staying there. Interpol, the Dotsons, every band you can imagine. I mean, as soon as we walked in, we checked in, a guy came up to us and asked if we wanted heroin. Nathan Folliwell. We were all little stoners. That's all we did. Caleb Folliwell. My manager grabbed him by his throat and slammed him against the wall and said, don't you fucking ever talk to these guys again. We didn't even know. We were like, do we know that we want that? Nathan Folliwell. NME Magazine had a little concert series where there were 5 or 6 clubs throughout London, and you would play a different one every other night. We kind of made the rounds, but we stayed at the Columbia. I remember band names there that I don't even think are around anymore, like the Star Spangles. The bands in that hotel scared the ever-living shit out of us. That is why we did not do drugs. Those guys. I mean guys shooting up out in the open. I mean guys coming out of the closet with their pants down and a girl coming out right after them. It was full on. There will never be a place like that ever again. Harmar Superstar. We all lived at the Columbia Hotel. The lobby of that hotel at 3 in the morning every night would be me and Karen O smashing the little chandelier. And somehow it would be put back together when we'd all wake up. Kings of Leon would be in one corner, and the Killers in the other. You'd Indian leg wrestle with my morning jacket in the breakfast room. Jim James took me down. Brandon Flowers. Did we stay at the Columbia Hotel? Yeah, we did. Shit. Ronnie Vannucci. We would share, like, 1 or 2 rooms. Harmar Superstar. You'd get a room that had 5 smaller-than-twin beds, so you and your band would look like a pack of gum. Brandon Flowers. I remember well we were all sharing rooms, and we took turns throwing up in the bathtub. Ronnie Vannucci. I never drank before. Brandon got me into drinking. And I remember he and I just throwing up in an avocado green bathtub together. I never threw up in the bathtub. I'm a toilet guy. Flush it down. Paul Banks. That was the best. We stayed there on that first tour. Sometimes there'd be this really old, horrible fucking asshole bartender just being belligerent. He would still be serving everyone drinks until 5 in the morning, but just talking shit all the while. There was also this young guy that everybody really liked. I want to say his name was John. We would just be sitting there in this room off the lobby, a big, big room, just getting fucking plowed. Then, if you separated off with somebody, there were conference rooms that you could find for privacy. Or there was this large women's bathroom with sofas in it that you could, you know.
Karen Ruttner. I remember one time the Interpol guys had tried to buy cocaine, and in London at the time it was hard to come by. They had been swindled. Somebody sold them like 80 pounds of baking soda. They tried snorting it. I felt really bad for them, and I had Adderall because I was in college. I said, "Don't worry, guys, I got this, I got this." I was just chopping up lines of this blue shit on the table.
Paul Banks. I'm pretty sure we weren't doing drugs on the tables, but that could have also simply been because you wouldn't want to publicize to the other 40 people that you were packing.
Karen Ruttner. It became one of my favorite places to go to. There was this one particular night Carlos brought me there. The Polyphonic Spree were there in their robes, even though it was long after showtime. Harmar was in his boxer shorts dancing on a tabletop. The Dotsons were all on ecstasy because it was one of their birthdays. I think Carlos was on ecstasy. I was on Adderall. Bobby Gillespie was there too, and Mick Rock, and Evan Dando, who was barefoot walking around the lobby basically in circles. He introduced himself to me twice in the span of an hour. I was just like, this is the coolest thing ever. I was coming from fucking Barnard. I had gone to yeshiva on the Upper East Side, had a totally sheltered childhood. Basically, Carlos adopted me. He was like, "You're my date for the night." And that was that. So he took me out, and then the rest was history. I wouldn't call it dating, but yeah, I slept with him that night. And my poor friend that I was staying with called, like, my mom because I didn't come home. She was like, "Where were you?" I was like, "Oh, I met this band."
Nathan Followill. I won't name the band because they're friends of ours now. And the guy that said this is not even in the band anymore. Caleb Followill. Interpol. Nathan Followill. We were already kind of self-conscious, and it was like rock and roll summer camp. There were so many bands there. We knew that we were the flavor of the month, so we tried to keep to ourselves. But I remember the elevator opened, and we got out, and it was the lobby floor. We were going to the bar, and this one guy from this band was standing there and goes, "Oh, look, it's Lynyrd Skynyrd." And we were like, "You vampire-looking motherfucker. Like, we will break this bottle and cut you. You have no idea who you're fucking with right now." Caleb Followill. Yeah. When we were in the Columbia, everyone was doing blow on the tables and banging in the closets and doing all this shit. So we're like, sweet. We're smoking a joint and we're walking around in our bell-bottoms and our mustaches, and Carlos from Interpol walked up and said, "Hey, are you guys from Almost Famous?" And my brother said, "Hey, are you a fucking mortician?" I was like, "Nice, Nathan." He shut up. So I thought that we didn't like them. But now I'm actually very, very friendly with all of those guys. But not Carlos. He's a mortician. Nathan Followill. I think I called him McFly. I'm not sure. But by the end of that night, we were like, fuck this. We can hold our own. This is every man for himself. Chapter 60. I'm only 16 and I've already had crabs 3 times.
Regina Spektor. It was the Strokes and the Kings of Leon and me. It was trial by fire. Sarah Lewitton. I remember those shows. This was before Room on Fire came out. Jenny Eliscu. Kings of Leon immediately felt like a perfect thing for the Strokes audience. And I loved Regina. She is amazing. But it definitely felt... I guess, having seen Moldy Peaches open for them previously, it would be weird to say it felt incongruous. But it did feel like they were challenging their audience by choosing something so aesthetically different.
Steve Ralbovsky. Regina was more like Kate Bush or something. It didn't really fit with the styles and the sounds of those other two bands.
Regina Spektor. The very first day I ran off the stage crying, there were these three frat boys in the front row who were like, "Go fucking home!" I looked to the right and all of the Strokes dudes were on the side of the stage supporting me. I played the whole set and then I dashed to my dressing room and I was just crying with mascara running down my face. Fab and Julian, they came up and said, "That was great!" I was like, "Everybody hates me." They told me that I had to toughen up. If I'm scared, I still think about that moment.
Ryan Gentles. Yeah, she had a tough time. She wasn't received too well by a bunch of kids who were trying to get drunk off beer in Chicago, you know? She had a hard time. There were two big old party rock bands coming up, and Regina was there with just a little voice on a piano banging on a box with a drumstick. Steve Trachtenbreut. She got booed every night, but it was good for her. It toughened her up. Jim Merlis. I didn't love Regina. Those records were too quirky for me. I thought she was one of those people who was like, "I have talent, but I'm not really going to use my talent. I'm just going to be strange." Give it to Julian. He saw the commercial potential there. Ryan Gentles. Julian pretty much single-handedly got Regina Spektor her deal. That was all him. He took her CD to record labels and made appointments and brought her in. Steve Ralbovsky. I came into my office one morning and Julian had slipped me a handwritten note on a rumpled sheet of paper with a CD of Regina Spektor songs. To paraphrase, it read, "She's great. I would really like her to become part of our family. Really hope you like this." This was not something he ever did. You knew he was a supporter of other bands. But he wasn't a going out and talking about bands kind of guy. For him to advocate was really kind of a serious thing. And I could see it had merit. I could see where he was coming from. Her life story was fascinating, and there was a coolness about her. She was hard to approach. She was awkward, and in conversation she would curse up a storm, telling the whole story about how they got here from Russia. I think he was captivated by her outsiderness. Ryan Gentles. And then everybody passed. If those labels knew what I knew, they would have just signed her. Julian is the most remarkable human being I've ever met in my life. Most people have 5 senses. He's got 6. I've worked closely enough with him to see him so many times defy the odds against what seems like the practical, logical thing, that I just trust him inherently. He's not always right. But his fucking track record is seriously impressive. Steve Ralbovsky. With the Regina thing, I thought, well, I might do this to make you happy, but... But you always worry about signing bands' friends. I also thought it would be good for Regina to separate herself from that pack. Because you don't want to ever be a protege of the Strokes. Ryan Gentles. Of course, DreamWorks eventually signed her. And she's been wildly successful.
Regina Spektor. The Strokes themselves basically funded me on that tour. I would go and eat my meals with them, and they would always pick up the check. I would do the reach, but Albert would get it, or Julian would pick it up, or Nick. Even if I went and had lunch at the airport with Nikolai, he would pay for it. They fed me. I would go to my dressing room and it would have, like, chips and salsa, and I would go to their dressing room and it would have, like, cold cuts, and they would say, "Go ahead, eat, drink." They shared everything, and it got me through. I remember on the flight back home when the tour ended, they upgraded me, and I flew fancy.
Ryan Gentles. Look, it's not Motley Crue in 1987. This is the girl who Julian handpicked to come on tour with us. We wanted her to hang out. We wanted her to feel welcome. And she was one person. She was a little tiny mouse, and she was like the nicest girl ever. And please...